Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. They are our local print partners. Of course, our last conversation was one of our Urbanite radio conversations. But the similarity between these two conversations is that we have an elected official in our midst, the Maryland State Delegate from Baltimore County, Dan Morheim, who's also an emergency room physician. But we're not talking politics, which is really nice to have politicians on the air and not talk politics.
Well, we can segue over to that a little bit if you like.
Can we get his mic on? Try that again. All right. I'm sorry, Dan.
We could talk about politics. This will work into politics because everything does.
Well, there is some politics in your book in terms of—
There is some politics in my book. Yep.
And the book, by the way, Dan Morheim is an emergency room physician, was the chief at Sinai for a long time.
Franklin Square, actually. I'm at Sinai. And healthcare for the homeless, actually. That's where I've been working the last 3 years.
I thought you were chief at Sinai Emergency
Room. No, Franklin Square a long time ago. But then I went over to Sinai. I'm still on staff there. Wonderful place. Good institutions.
And now you're at— Hopkins School of Public Health.
I've been on the faculty at the Hopkins School of Public Health for 12 years and in office for 18, deputy majority leader in the House. But finally, I wrote a book.
The book is called The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Medical World. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888 because we're talking about part of what you can join us here with your own stories about end-of-life experiences with your family members, things that have happened, how things could have maybe done differently, how you can prepare for that in ways we're not thinking about so you can control what happens to you at the end of your life, not just in the middle of it. So it's one of the things we're going to be talking about with Dan Morheim. As I was thinking about you coming on the last few weeks looking at your book, there was an interesting piece that I read. I don't think it wasn't Yes Magazine. I'll come to which magazine it was. But it was about a physician, by a physician. It was an Orion, a physician who wrote about why the majority of physicians in America will say no to extra measures to be kept alive at the end.
For themselves.
Right. No matter what they do for their patients.
Yeah.
That they rejected for themselves.
Well, that's because we know that these things are tough challenges. Look, we're in a unique place in human history, actually. It's kind of amazing and even upbeat in the sense that we're the first generation in human history that likely has some say about how we die. And that's a really powerful concept. 100 years ago, you got your disease, you got whatever happened, you pretty much dealt your cards, that was it. And now people, fortunately, are living longer, happier, more productive lives, maybe surviving one or two bouts of cancer or heart attack. But eventually the end comes. And this is a topic that most people, of course, don't want to talk about. Look, I'm an elected official. I have to go out to my district and people say, talk to me about the special session and the taxes. And after we do that, I talk about death and dying. Then I ask them to vote for me. You know, it's a challenge. But got it all covered here. But the idea is that there are ways that are legal, free, straightforward, where you can begin to influence that process. And not enough of us take care of that. And so my push, my mission, my crusade on this is to have people complete advanced directives. And the book is really stories about why that's important. And it's available for everybody, but not enough of us do it. And when we get to those junctures in life, and there are a lot of stories now because just of the demographics, the baby boom generation is making these decisions for our parents and soon enough for ourselves. So it affects every single person. There's no one that gets out of here alive. I've been to med school. I'm reasonably sure of that fact. As we say at Hopkins, the death rate in every country in the world is the same, right? One per person. So, but rather than be fearful and hide our heads and pretend, we have an opportunity now to deal with it in a way that no one has before, and that's a good thing.
I mean, I think that there are a lot of wonderful anecdotal stories that you talk about in this book. So I want to get some of them because some of the stories are really, really interesting. But I was interested that how in the beginning of the book, that you took assisted suicide out of the picture. Not, you talked about it during the book in different parts, and people make decisions about what they want to do with their lives. But you, but it's not something you should decide to focus on.
There's so many basic things we can do right now that we're not taking advantage of before we have to get to these very controversial and incendiary level topics. And, you know, the book is, in fact, largely stories with practical right. information. I do need to say that Maya Angelou endorsed the book on the front
cover.
I saw that. And that was really validating. And I know part of the reason that she did it, and believe me, she didn't need to put her name on my book to advance her career. She did it because you know, she's really a premier person of American literature. But she really liked the tone, the style, and the way the book unfolds with stories that are meaningful and are real. And then practical information. This isn't a civics lesson. It's not a lesson in morals or ethics. It's really here's practical things you can do for yourself and equally important for your family.
I mean, the all scattered through the book are the issues of economics and the end of life and where the money is spent and how it is spent, how difficult it is for some people. And some of the stats are really amazing. I mean, just to start with one of the early ones, you said that the more people are dying, because you start off with the story about the man whose name I'm forgetting, which you'll remember, who died at home, but then his great-grandson or grandson did not die at home and died in a hospital, right?
Right. But at the same time, the technology is enabling us to live longer and happier lives. We're also are cut off from participation in being with our loved ones when they die. I think it's, you know, intensive care units are great and remarkable places, but I personally don't want to be in one hooked to tubes and monitors, and I have done this with patients myself as a practicing physician, but doing it long past any hope of reasonable recovery, life, and it's futile and expensive, but then people die alone. And although yeah. the practitioners are caring, it's not the same as when your family's there. You know, 100 years ago, sometimes people died at home, but their family was gathered around. The doctors actually knew the patients as people.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to get at is the best of both worlds. Your family's there. Your doctor actually knows you. You get the best of technology. But when enough is enough, allowing natural death is the appropriate thing to do.
Join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dan Moorheim, the physician this time, not just the delegate, for his book, The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World, 410-319-8888. I was thinking about the article I was thinking about I read in Utney Reader. That's where I read the article.
Okay.
By the physician. But and we'll post that so people can see it when we post your information about your book. Because he talked about just that, and as you do in your book, and the question I have, a broader question is, why is it so difficult for that to happen at the end of life, for somebody to not be stuck in a hospital, you know, dying, tied up to tubes, as opposed to be able to go home and just be put on pain medication, have somebody visit, have, you know, the nurses come in and just allow you to die at home. Why is that so difficult?
First, I think it's beginning to change a little bit because people are beginning to think about it. You know, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, women couldn't talk about breast cancer, and now we can. And it's a comfortable topic, although an uncomfortable situation. I think we're at a point now starting out, and hopefully this book and other discussions, the articles you've read, will allow people to start to discuss those points. It's difficult because we are very fond of our technology and have come to accept all the miracles that it can provide, and it has. But at some point, even that can't do anymore. We all understand that. We're at that point because we physicians, and I'm one of them, have tended to take the position that more care is always better care. I think sometimes we have to redefine what care and caring is all about. And the public has come to expect it. But the other reason is we just haven't had enough of these discussions. I can't tell you the number of times, whether it's in the grocery store, or I'll tell you one story. I was at a political event in my political life. I was standing in a reception and talking to two really hard-boiled, tough lobbyists. I mean, these were real tough guys. Attorneys, and they said what they were doing. They turned to me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I wrote this book called The Better End About End-of-Life Care." And they both start to tell me the stories that they just had with their parents. And they started to cry.
Yeah.
These were hard-boiled, tough guys, and they started to cry. And so as we begin to allow ourselves to tell the stories, to talk about the things that we've gone through, that we've seen with our friends and families, I think this will all begin to change. And people will make rational decisions. I mean, if you get hit by a truck, you definitely want to go to the hospital and go to the emergency room and get the best of technical care. But if you're dying over a protracted illness with cancer and dementia and you have tubes everywhere and holes created to put tubes in to feed you, do you really want to end up in a hospital at that point? I mean, is that the right thing to do? The amazing thing is that those decisions can be made by you as the individual.
We have the power.
We have the power to do that. And that's the point. Dignity, empowerment, and your values.
I mean, one of the things though I want to talk to you about was that. I mean, let's go through some of the stories. I mean, you talk about Alberta's story. It was very moving to me in the book. And when she was coming to the end, you talk about Alberta's assets were just too great for her to qualify for Medicare. They had to go within that kind of spend-down process where you have to spend all your money before Medicaid can kick in. So, I mean, the way you describe the end of just all the machines she was hooked up to and how she passed away and the struggle she had with dementia and her body falling apart. But if you're in a spend-down world, let's talk about that in a minute. How much choice do you have? I mean, even if you had this piece that you wrote about how I want to die, if that's still the case of how you can spend your money, what Medicaid will cover, you don't have total choice.
I think we're going to change those financial systems and rewards along the way. But the first step goes back to the individual. This is one of the rare things where the system actually doesn't have to dictate to you what's going to happen. And when people start to make different choices, I think the money will begin to change. The most important reason to complete an advanced directive form, which is free, straightforward, been legal in the United States for over 20 years, easily available on, Attorney General Doug Gansler left, you can go to Attorney General's website in Maryland and print one out and fill it out and you're done. The main reason to do this is so you get the personalized, empowered, dignified care according to your own values, which, by the way, can be everything. You can check the box that says, I want everything done. You can check a box that says, pull the plug. Most people don't choose those. And most people choose the one that says, keep me going as long as I got a pretty good shot at it. But if, things are really bad and I'm in pain. And when we do that, the money savings will accrue the right way.
So I'm going to talk about how we get there. We're going to take a break and take a little traffic break. We're going to come back with Dan Morheim talking about his book, The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Terms in Today's Modern Medical World, 410-319-8888. And we'll talk about how you can make those decisions and make them now for your end of life. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Dr. Dan Morheim, of course, is a member of the House of Delegates from Baltimore County, a physician, an emergency room physician, who is an author of a new book called The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. And Dan is now actually teaching and working in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Hopkins, besides being a deputy majority leader of the House of Delegates. 410-319-8888 is the number here. When we left off, Dan, we were talking about And folks, join us here about this. This is some important stuff just about how to control what happens to your lives and your family's lives. What we were alluding to earlier before we went off the air was something called advanced directives that everybody can have to talk about what they want to have happen to them at the end of life. And one of the things we were talking about off the air was that in the African-American community, there's a really low percentage of people who have advanced directives.
Advanced directives of free, simple, straightforward form. Take some time to think about it, but it's easy to fill out and get Attorney General's website and get it on your, whatever religion you are, they've got them. You get them from an attorney. Get it in any hospital. They're in my book. In every state, you can get them. Just got to fill them out. And we did a study at Hopkins School of Public Health. Keisha Pollack, my friend, colleague, and co-author of the study, and we looked at something that had never been looked at before. How many people have advanced directives? After all, 100% of us are going to die. But how many have actually completed this little bit of important paperwork? And it turns out that it's only about a third of the population. But we asked how many people want one, want to have some control over this situation. And we've seen it, when control doesn't happen, 90%, 85-90% of the people want them. But when we broke down the demographics farther, we saw that the minority community was woefully lower than any other. probably 10-15% of the minority community, 40% of the affluent white community. So even in the affluent older white community where you think it's going to be high, it's not even a majority. But in the minority community, it's even lower. And so part of the idea here is to empower the minority community when it's dealing with the healthcare system in all areas, and especially this one.
Well, let's get down to kind of the nitty-gritty of what that means when you say that your the power you have in the healthcare system. I mean, what does it mean to do an advance directive? What do you control in that process?
There's really three parts to an advance directive. The first part designates, in effect, if you can't make decisions for yourself about how much care you want.
In a coma, in an accident.
Right. Now, when you're competent, you can make those decisions tough as they are. But if you're incompetent or unable because you are in a coma or some other terrible disease state, could be temporary or permanent, what kind of decisions do you want? And so the choices typically are, I want everything done all the way to the, you know, as far as it'll go. On the other end of the spectrum is, don't do too much, let nature take its course pretty quick. Most people don't choose those. What they do choose is the middle path, which is keep me going for as long as possible, as long as I'm reasonably comfortable. People tend to say, and I do, if I'm competent mentally and I'm not in intractable pain. That's the first part of the advance directive. The second part is I want to designate somebody who'll make these decisions for me. Usually it's a trusted person, a loved one, someone you should have a discussion with. So for me, it's my wife, and then after that, my adult children. You can also specify that you don't want somebody involved. You may have your cousin Bill. You don't want him involved in making these decisions. Don't trust that guy. Or your sister or something, and you say, I don't want that person involved. You can do that too. And then they will make decisions also, because sometimes the medical decisions are pretty complicated and cannot all be covered under that first arrangement. And the third part of the advance directive is some miscellaneous other items like organ donation and burial. I personally favor organ donation whenever possible, because I've also seen patients who are alive because other people graciously gave the gift of life through their organs. But that's basically what an advance directive form is. The challenge is not enough of us complete them. And the idea is you fill out that form, you give one to make sure your family, your doctor, your hospital, your lawyer, whatever. You can discuss it with your clergy, however you want to do it. But in the minority community, it's really only about 15% of the population is completed. And so I think part of the reason Maya Angelou supports this book, Ben Carson endorsed this book, Montel Williams endorsed this book, also the dean of the School of Public Health, Michael Clagg, is because we really want to increase that awareness in the population and have people take control. Now, once they complete the form, there's another challenge. The healthcare system has to do a better job of recognizing and honoring those forms. But we see them so infrequently, it's very hard to do. So there's a long, long path to go here, but the demographics, huge population surge, 10,000 people every day turning 65, the biggest population bulge. We're going to have to deal with this one way or another. It's going to happen. We might as well get ahead of the curve.
410-319-8888. Join us here with your own stories about what has happened in your family, what questions you have about how you get these, how you control that part of your life. In the book, there's an overview of forms. This is really important for what we want to have happen to us. I mean, I think that, and you really go through that in terms of whether people have choices to prolong life or not to prolong life. And these are tough decisions for people to make. I mean, you talk about the cases of Karen Quinlan and Nancy Cruzon. We all hear Terry Schiavo, but we don't know the other cases as well that really had a lot to do with beginning to change how we look at this end of life.
Well, it also points out this is not just for old people. The three most famous cases in American legal history all involve women under 30. People remember Terry Schiavo from about 6-7 years ago.
Right.
And how she was in an accident or injury and became brain dead and then effectively brain dead, and how her husband and her parents got in a horrible legal fight that became a national headline. Now, they didn't start that way. They actually were all on good terms. Karen Quinlan and Nancy Cruzan were earlier cases that really set up what became the Patient Self-Determination Act, which was enacted by the Federal Congress in 1990 and said, yes, technology is advanced. These decisions that didn't need to come up before because we couldn't keep people alive. Now we're going to come up more and more. We better have some strategy to deal with it. When my kids turned 18, I gave him an advanced directive form. And one of my daughters turned to me and she said, that's fine, Dad, because when I was 16, I got a driver's license and I checked organ donation. So, you know, and what I do when I'm 18 will be different when I'm 28 or 38 or 58. You can change this form as often as you like. The last one that you've completed is operative. And as your circumstances or your values or your beliefs or your relationships with other people change, you can change this form. The danger is when you're left without one, because in chaos, family strife ensues, and all kinds of things may happen to you that you may not have wished to have happen.
And those things will happen because people have different kind of feelings, whether they are.
Something's going to happen. There's just no way to avoid that. I mean, there is a default, and it's often chaotic.
Well, I mean, whether it is for religious reasons or for personal reasons or emotional reasons, people, when they see somebody really sick, they want to hold on to them. They don't want them to go. So they'll do everything they can to keep them alive. And if you don't have these directives out there, someone else makes that choice. If you decide, I just don't want to be plugged up this way. I want to be able to be, let's be, give me pain medication. Don't force feed me. Just let me be.
The experience had changed my perspective was when my stepfather died.
Oh,
and
great,
he really was the man who raised me, a wonderful man. And he had some terrible illnesses, not of his own doing. He had rheumatic heart fever as a child. Back in the 1920s, that happened. His heart valves were damaged. And then he was on dialysis towards the end of his life. And he could see that he was deteriorating physically, intellectually. He could see that the next few months were going to be going down, getting worse and worse and worse with no relief in sight. And one day he called me up and he said, I'm not going back to dialysis. It's one of his lucid hours. And he said, I'm not going back. And I said, well, that means you're going to die. He said, I understand that. But I'm going to die anyways in the next few weeks. I'd rather do it this way on my own. And so my mother and I took care of him. In the first few days, family and friends gathered at our house, said goodbyes. There were a lot of poignant moments, some laughs, some tears. It was a very moving experience. And then the last 4 or 5 days, just my mother and I took care of Max until he passed away, quietly, comfortably, with pain medication and sedation at home. It was such a marked contrast to the kinds of deaths I'd witnessed as a practicing physician, in which we're doing things to people even though we know in our hearts and our minds that they're not going to do any good, maybe prolong life for another 10 minutes, another 2 hours, pushing down on somebody's chest and feeling all their ribs crack, sticking tubes in their windpipe,
yes,
taking big needles and starting large bore IVs and putting needles in the chest or the neck or the groin. I mean, I have done all these things, and I don't feel good about some of them. Sometimes they're life-saving and important. But at the end of the day, it's not my decision. It's the patient's decision. My job as a physician is to provide people with as much accurate information as I possibly can. My job as a legislator is to let everybody know what their rights are as a citizen. And then it's up to you. And that, if there is an upbeat side to this topic, as usually it sends people running to the exits, but not all the time. People will stay and listen and go, wow, this is really amazing. We can actually have some influence here. It's like being at sea, you know, choppy ocean sea, and you're in your little boat. Do you want to be with a sail and a rudder or not? This gives you a sail and a rudder. You can make some decisions for yourself.
One of the things you talk about in this book, you talk about people facing dementia, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, and I'm going to come back to a couple of the stories, the story of Abby and Dave Eckhart, and some of the stories that you talk about I think are mm-hmm. important to kind of talk about here to give a personal sense. But you write in here that President Reagan, who had dementia, just couldn't take care of himself at all, was able to afford expensive individual care that helped keep him alive for years while sparing his family many burdens. But for most Americans, dementia leads to a great personal economic hardship. It can cost many thousands of dollars each year to take care of a person in dementia. I mean, and you talk about purchasing long-term care insurance, but that, to me, is part of the issue we're facing. I mean, because you can have control, don't want any extraordinary measures, but if you don't have the means, you could still be locked up, in a sense, quote-unquote locked up, in a hospital or ICU and die that way.
That can happen. And dementia is a huge problem. There's going to be 25, 50 million Americans who are going to start experiencing dementia over the next 25 to 30 years. It's going to bankrupt the country unless we figure out some way to deal with it. Now, Do you want the heavy hand of government making these decisions? Do you want private insurance companies that are seeking the bottom line profit? Do you want religious entities? Do you want doctors? Do you want ethics committees? A lot of decisions you can make yourself and have it, you know, sort of like the way you want it to be as close as possible. I think there's no way not to deal with these things. The point is, are we going to deal with them rationally with foresight and open our eyes and recognize what's going on, or are we just going to wait for the end? You know, I remember one patient, she's about 88 years old, and she collapsed at home. She'd up to that point had been an independent woman living in her life, doing fine. Husband had passed a few years before. She was collapsed, full resuscitative efforts were done by the paramedics, brought to the emergency room. We do a CAT scan. She has a massive intracranial hemorrhage, meaning a big bleed inside her brain from which there's going to be no recovery. Her family starts to gather as these things happen bit by bit, you know, one here, one there, and they call each other. And I go to I'm shuttling back and forth between the family and the patient because there's still a lot of work to do to keep her going. And what I see is what often happens. The family is getting into a huge argument, tension, old wounds, as sometimes happens.
Right.
Very emotional. But she did complete an advance directive. Somebody brought it in, and I read it, and it basically says, look, if I have no chance of meaningful survival, no heroic measures, no tube in my windpipe, no pressure medicines to keep my blood pressure up and my heart beating. So I sit down with the family, and they're going through this big harangue, and it's really unpleasant for them, and finally, there's a calm moment, and they look at me, and I say, well, here's what she says. And, you know, I appreciate everybody's input, and you have a lot of different opinions here, but my job is to respect the patient's wishes. That's what I'm obligated to do. And so I'm going to go take the tube out and stop the medicines. And you know what? You think it might be an explosion. In fact, everybody calms down. They're appreciative and grateful that the decision was made for them in a legal and responsible way. And I said, if you want to come in the room with me when this happens, please do. Those of you who do can, and those who don't, and they come in the room with me. We turn off all the machines, and over the next hour, she dies quietly. Without that, she would have been in an intensive care unit for a week and then died. The more clear-cut case than many, but something that's happening every day in every emergency room, in every intensive care unit, in every hospital in the state and the nation. So it's not just about you. It really took care of her family. This woman had the foresight not only to determine what her own care would be, but she took care of her family. I mean, we say we love our loved ones, and then we don't do the things that make things easier for them. She did, and that was another important lesson for me.
One of the stories, a number of stories in here, that was Abby, who took control.
Abby took control. She had widespread cancer, had good treatments and good recoveries and remission, but then eventually started getting worse and worse, and determined the things that were value to her. And also from her illness, as we often hear from folks with serious illness, you know, they begin to appreciate the little things that we disregard. You know, a bite of chocolate. Going to the movies becomes not just an evening at the movies, it becomes a special occasion. A friend stopping by isn't, say, an interruption of your day or an annoyance. It's a golden moment to be with somebody. And she gets into the mode of experiencing all the fullness of this, including walking her dog. And at the end, she decided, after, you know, extensive medical procedures, when clearly the end was coming, to just die quietly at home. And that's what she did. And it provided a lot of comfort to her friends and family. And it made her appreciate everybody else appreciate the important things in life.
Folks, we'll be here for another 10 minutes or so with Dr. Dan Moorheim, of course, member of the House of Delegates, Deputy Majority Leader. But an emergency room physician, professor at the Hopkins School of Public Health, who's written a book called The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. Really important thing for all of us to wrestle with in terms of how we can control what happens to us at the very end.
And let me say two other things. Yeah. One, the book is available on Amazon.com, and there's a website, thebetterend.com. So if anybody wants to get it there, take a look. And done a lot of speaking at all kinds of organizations, so I'm available, and you can reach me through thebetterend.com. But the other thing is, there's no discussion of healthcare reform or possibility without talking about money.
Right.
So let me say a couple of words about money, because this is something I wrestle with as a legislator. Medicare, the federal funding for seniors, over 25% of all Medicare dollars are spent on end-of-life care, meaning the last 6 months. Hospice is a great thing. I think more and more people are going to move in that direction. But if you think of the Medicare program and the billions of dollars and how much we as taxpayers are paying, fully one quarter, maybe going up to a third soon, will be end-of-life care. Wouldn't it be the right way to reduce some of that expense by having people take individual responsibility and complete these advanced directive forms? At the state level, Medicaid, which is health care funding for poor people and disabled, is the single biggest line item in the Maryland state budget. It's about $4 billion. Of that, 25% of the money goes to 75% of the people who are helped by Medicaid, which is children. But 75% of the money goes to 25% of the people who are helped by Medicaid, just the opposite, which is seriously ill people. And a large chunk of that is end-of-life care. In fact, it's on the order of about $400 or $500 million a year in state Medicaid money is spent on end-of-life care. Now, the Medicaid population has a very low rate, generally speaking, of rate of completion of advanced directives. Let's say that that was increased as a result of all these activities. We might save $100 million. Well, that would have, if that were the case, we wouldn't have had to raise any taxes and do a bunch of other things, or could take that money and put it in other things in healthcare that are much more important. How about dental care for children, mental health, addiction? Instead, we spend it in this other area for which there really is not that much return. These judgments can be made by people, not by institutions. But when you think of that amount of money, and I see it as a physician, we only have so much to go around. I'd rather spend it where there's some real returns and things that I believe are underfunded, like health care for children, like mental health, like addiction. But it's so easy to spend so much money on end-of-life care because we're afraid to have these discussions and afraid to confront the issues.
Some calls in before we're done. 410-319-8888 calls that are coming in. And as soon as I see the names pop up, I will get them on the air with us. I mean, because one of the things that it's still, though, even with that expensive. Well, we do have one. Let someone else in here.
Okay.
Besides myself. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Question about this whole procedure is that doctors should not be, wouldn't you agree, in the business of making prognoses about whether people are going to live or die. They're in the business of diagnosing and treating patients, not prognosticating how long a person has to live, whether a person will live. All those things are up to God, not the doctor. And therefore, to urge people to do advanced directives where they could be told by a doctor, you know, the prognosis is not good for you, puts an enormous amount of guilt and concern about their situation to take it off of their loved ones, so they're having an emotional appeal put on them to maybe end their life when it's unnecessary. There have been many cases of people who were prognosed to only have 6 months to live, and they've lived years after that. So you doctors, my opinion is, should not be in the business of asking any patients to make advanced directives so that they can be the ones to decide that their life is foreshortened or their life is not worth living.
Okay, Dan?
Well, I don't think doctors are in the prognostication business. What this is about individuals making the decisions. And advanced directives does not mean a limitation or diminution or cutting off of anything. For Mike or for anybody who feels that that's their concern, then they ought to check the box that says, I want everything done all the way through. Keep me going. Maybe there's some chance of recovery. And that's a perfectly fine option for those who want it. For others, they may take a different point of view. The problem is that in the absence of an individual making a decision, it's up to guesswork for everybody else, their friends, their families, and so on. So ultimately, it really is about empowerment of individuals, and you can have it according to your personal values. They may not be mine, they may not be Mark's, but they may be other people's as well. And I think you should look at it that way.
Thank you, Mike. 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air.
I think you're a fascist.
All right, you stop. Alan, stop. First of all, we don't do name-calling and throwing out slurs and screaming at people. Alan, stop. If you have something you want to say and a criticism and a question, say it without the screaming and slurs. Go ahead, if you can.
I think, yes, I can, and I don't appreciate the sarcasm, but I think that...
I wasn't being sarcastic. I was being straight ahead.
Okay, well, anyway, this man's ideology, during the Nazis talked about useless eaters and useless people and exterminating useless people. And when he's talking about these people don't have much life, that, you know, these people can't communicate. We should be using money for young people, but they get these old people out of the way. Get them out of there because they're useless. That's fascist ideology. There's nothing short of it. And for him to even to talk about taking care away, this many dollars can go for this or this many dollars can go for that, that's a fascist ideology.
Well, let him respond. Dan?
Well, obviously, I don't agree. I think the name calling's inappropriate. But again, the point is that if you don't make those decisions, someone else is going to make them for you, Alan. And so you can check, do this any way you like. This is about individual empowerment according to your values. And I think that's an entirely reasonable posture to be in.
I think that this is the kind of two pieces just were brought up. I think that has to do with, I mean, because you were talking earlier about the cost of medical care at the end. And I think that kind of...
Well, what I also said was that the most important thing is that you have care according to your values and your wishes. There is a finite amount of cost, you know, that's there, and everybody gets to make the determination about it. Now, you know, for me, what my advanced directive says, as long as my mind is functioning and I'm not in intractable pain, think of somebody like Stephen Hawking, whose mind is functioning,
right.
He's not in intractable pain.
Who has ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
And he's a brilliant astrophysicist, continues to work. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to continue to exist.
But there's someone in your book, a friend of yours, a physician who had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease,
right.
Chose a different path.
He chose a different path, and that was his path. And I think that's the point. But at some point in life, whether it's determined by the medical care system or by God or whatever value system you believe in, we're all going to die. And the question is, how, you know, when do you want to have some influence about when and how that happens? I am absolutely not interested in imposing my values or views on anybody. In fact, without advanced directives, that's in fact what happens. People start having other folks' values imposed on them. But why have that?
I mean,
do what you want.
I mean, the bottom line here is what we're talking about is that is somebody being able to make the decision, okay,
And it's best made not when you're not in crisis.
Right, exactly.
You want to make it when you're awake, alert, talk about it, think about it, reflect on your values, talk about it with your friends, your family, your clergy, spiritual advisors, attorneys, meditate on it, whatever you like to do, and then make your decision yourself. It's very difficult to do these things when a crisis happens, because then it's hard for any of us to think clearly and rationally.
I think it's important to what you were saying is that we're not talking about making decisions for somebody else. You're talking about making decisions about your own life. You can make the decision to keep me alive for as long as you can.
You absolutely can, and there are people who do that. And one of the stories in the book is exactly
right.
That. A man who wanted to continue is actually a patient that I took care of. He wanted everything done. You know, long past what many people consider to be any benefit to him, but that was his choice, and we respected it. And, you know, of course, ultimately he died. He had a very bad cancer, but, you know, he got as much out of it as he could, and that's what he wanted, that's what we did, and that's fair.
We're talking with Dr. Dan Morheim. The book is a really well-written, I would say, really well-written book, very simple to understand, and this is not...
And short, too.
And short. And I think that before we go to break, let's just get one quick caller in here, and then we'll go to break because we then have to go talk to the folks in the Chicago Police Department and other folks working for the Lawyers Guild about the three people arrested in Chicago and charged with terrorism. And shall we go to, is it line two or line three? Which one should we take? Three. Line three. Johnny, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Johnny. Go ahead.
Are you okay?
Yes.
Yes. First of all, thank you, Dr. Dan. I know you, and... I respect the work that you're doing, and I still don't figure out how you could get it all done. But I'm glad you did on this particular topic. I've seen it twice with my mother and a cousin, and we all had they too have advanced directives, and it made it definitely able to be maneuvered as a total family. Nobody else had to get involved. We knew who was going to make the medical decisions. We knew what they wanted at the end. And I have it, and my wife has it. So it makes no decision about what God wants. God will choose that. It's just saying which choice I want God to be able to be presented with. That's all.
Thank you, Johnny. You said it beautifully.
And I would encourage people to go to Dan's website. The website is now again?
TheBetterN.com, www.TheBetterN.com. And you can also get it at Amazon. And it's an electronic Kindle versions. And
we'll get to
I'm glad we're having these good discussions. That's the important part. Let's start talking about this topic and not keep it a hidden topic.
And we can have that. It'll be on our website as well. So here with Dr. Dan Morheim, the book is The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World, endorsed by Maya Angelou and many others. You can find it at TheBetterN.com. As well as you can just link to it here from steinershow.org. And Dan, thanks so much
for being with us. Next time we talk about something easy like politics.
We'll try that next. Thank you, Dan. We'll be right back. We're going to be talking with the Chicago Police Department and then the National Lawyers Guild about what they're calling the NATO 3. So stay with us.